Jonathan Oxhorn, Emeritus Professor of Architecture, and as usual, we start with the land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gadigal
Aiyugu Nation,
the Kono
Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with
a historic and temporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayokono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayokono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Call to order. Our first order of business is the approval of minutes. As usual, these posted and distributed online in the form of verbatim transcript. If there are any typos, you should bring them to the attention of the Dean of Faculty's office. Otherwise, I will assume that this is approved through unanimous consent if I don't hear any objections. Hearing none, the minutes are approved. We start with a series of three motions, proposals, proposed resolutions, each of which will be presented, debated, and then voted on in the next week or two using the Qualtrics digital interface. We start with Caroline Levine on a proposed resolution for phase out single-use plastics. She'll have 5 minutes, and then there'll be 10 minutes for discussion.
Thank you so much. I'm representing Plastic Free Cornell, which is a group of faculty students and staff. So I have a student with me, Tim Williams, who was hugely important to the research that we did, including finding out this fact that Cornell generates approximately 1.6 million pounds of plastic waste every year, most of which ends up in landfills. Can I move the slides or? Okay, fantastic. So I'll move very quickly through the reasons why plastic waste should concern us. And the first is probably closest to home is the health impacts of single-use plastics. So single-use plastics are those that are designed to be used once and thrown away. And they contain all kinds of nasty chemicals, many of which are banned in other places like the EU. So these are three of the prominent chemicals used in single-use plastics. The next are the environmental effects, or the ecological effects. Around 8 million tons of plastic waste is dumped in the ocean annually. I was contacted by people in ocean studies to say, please, would you support this resolution? It's very important to those who study the oceans. Plastics can take up to 1,000 years to degrade, we know. Plastic pollution causes problems for both land and marine animals and for plants. And finally, plastics produce substantial emissions, and this is an infographic about how much plastic produces compared to coal. And third, the disproportionate impacts on community color. So many of you may have heard of Cancer Alley in Louisiana. It's a stretch of land where there's more than 150 plastic and other chemical plants, and it's got the highest rates of cancer in the U.S., among the highest rates. We also know that millions of tons of trash from wealthier countries are dumped in poorer countries around the world.
Very importantly, for our...
Of what we've learned as a group is that Cornell is actually lagging behind other universities on the phasing out of single-use plastics, most importantly, the SUNY system. So Cornell has opted out. It would be very easy for us to opt in since we are partly SUNY. But we discovered some interesting facts about other universities who have been phasing out single-use plastics before us. And one is that Colorado University of Boulder renegotiated their contract with Pepsi so that Pepsi took all the plastic bottles out of the vending machines and replaced them with aluminum, and at cost to Pepsi and not to the campus. So there's been lots of solutions, lots of different kinds of experiments with vending and alternatives of that kind at these other universities that have already done this. People often ask us, why not focus on better recycling? I can't emphasize this enough. Research after research has shown that recycling is a fraud or a scam promoted by the fossil fuel companies. It has been since the 1980s. It has never been a solution. It's always been an excuse to sell more plastic. Right now, the plastic companies, which are also fossil fuel companies, are planning to ramp up plastic production significantly over the next 10 to 15 years, and they're again turning to recycling to say it's fine to use more plastic because we'll recycle it. And again, at the very highest, 9% of plastics is the highest rate for successful plastic recycling programs across the world, and in the U.S. it's more like 5 to 6%. Number of people have asked, rightly so, about single-use plastics that we can't really replace yet. There may be new technologies coming down the road, but pipettes and pipette tips in labs are among those. So we have proposed in the resolution room for exceptions and for those exceptions to be reevaluated as new products come online. So as there may be replacements for single-use plastics, we would keep, Cornell would keep looking into that. And the question of why a ban has come up also. The research that we have read, and there's quite a lot of it, suggests that bans really work quickly and on a large scale. They work better than all kinds of other strategies to get people to change their habits. And recently there's been a really interesting study about trash from people collecting along shorelines that in states where there are plastic bag bans, there's significantly less plastic trash. So that's one of the pieces of research. Last slide is just to thank you and to show you most of the members of Plastic Free Cornell, although not all of them, to entertain your questions.
Digital questions, raise your hand. If you have a question or a comment here, just come up. Identify yourself and try to keep it to 2 minutes.
Rajesh Bhaskaran, RTE faculty member in mechanics and aerospace engineering and senator. I think, you know, I support this initiative and thank you very much for your collaborative work on this. One question I had is there kind of an educational component to it that I haven't had a chance to read the resolution, but, you know, it's like if this goes through and plastics are banned, you know, I can imagine, like, I'm in engineering and in Duffield, like the cafe, you know, it's like there's an explanation for why.
Perfect.
Thank you.
You can answer.
Yeah.
Just to say that the resolution itself doesn't spell out an educational plan, but it does propose a 5-year phase out, which would give lots of units time to figure out how to do this. And time also to educate the campus about what we're doing and why.
Actually, we have a conversation.
We have an online question comment. Ken Berman, go ahead.
Ken Berman, computer science. So thank you for the wonderful presentation. And I'm usually sure that the Senate, when people get 5 minutes, they usually take more, not less. But I'm spending a lot of time actually at companies that have done this and successfully. They compost almost everything and have substituted that. But one thing, though, that seems to be hard to get rid of is styrofoam, and I'm wondering if your resolution will cover styrofoam as well. I'm hoping that the answer is yes, and that we can move towards just eliminating the stuff, but it wasn't obvious to me from the presentation itself.
We did not do research into styrofoam. This is interesting to me because I don't run into it a lot on campus, so we would have to look into that, but it certainly seems worth phasing out along with plastic.
Hi, Chris Schaefer from Biomedical Engineering. Great work. I appreciate the carve out for scientific single-use plastics. That probably extends beyond pipette tips. There's other things. And then just one consideration, it's not just is there something available to replace it. There may also be history of experimentation and things like that that could dictate timelines of replacement. So some consideration for academics. I had another question, though, so I appreciate that carve-out. There are operations at Cornell that have a fair bit of single-use plastic look, and I'm wondering, have you consulted with them, and are they on board with the transition? I'm thinking about the dairy bar and their distribution of milk, for example.
That's a great question. We have moved this resolution through the Undergraduate Student Assembly and the University Assembly. The Employee Assembly is considering it, and they've had substantial numbers of questions that we've been able to answer satisfactorily so far. So they're taking it very seriously. So we haven't interviewed all of the different units, but dining is represented in the Employee Assembly, and so we've had pretty substantial conversations with them. Our understanding from the other SUNY campuses, including we've talked to Buffalo, Binghamton, and Cortland, is that they are seeing savings in dining by just not buying as much single-use plastic. So that's been something that we've been really interested to talk more about and are very hopeful that that would end up being inspiring and not just labor-intensive. The other thing is there may be a reduction in labor. So far, Cortland is seeing that when you have fewer single-use plastics that are disposed of, there's less that has to be picked up and taken away. And so although we're very mindful of the way that labor falls on staff more than any other group, so far we're not seeing that this is only a huge lift for staff units.
I guess the concern at the dairy bar would be they may need to buy new packaging equipment in order to put the milk in something other than plastic. So it might be worthwhile to reach out to them and understand what the scope and, like, do they need some kind of grandfather-in approach dealing with the lifetime of current equipment or something like that.
That's a great point, and we certainly will do that.
Nate Matthias on Zoom.
Hi, folks. Thanks for sharing this. Just wanted to add a note. New York State has banned polystyrene, extended polystyrene since 2020. And the ban on coolers came into place this year, so that may be why you're not seeing so much right now. Thanks for all your work.
Gilly Leshed, RTE Bowers. I have a question that follows up on Chris's question in terms of what are you proposing as the alternatives? Is the resolution just to ban single plastic use, or are you proposing, is it going to be single plastic compostables? Is it going to be multiple use? And then I understand that the dining facilities, they have the staff to mobilize, wash plates and cups and silverware, but other building cares aren't ready for multi-use utensils. And another alternative is people bring their own, right? So what are the alternatives, and are there, how is the university going to prepare for the resources required for the staff to put in the labor in terms of, say, washing silverware?
Yes, this is a super important question. One of the most inspiring sets of examples that we came across were actually from Europe. Some of our students studied abroad in places like Stockholm and Amsterdam, and it's very clear that when you change a culture, people adjust quite quickly. And so those are places where there is no single-use plastic around. People bring their own, or they eat in, or there's just a kind of culture shift. So that's what we really want to encourage, is not just replacing everything with more waste, but actually changing the ways that we behave on campus. The five-year plan is precisely to give people the time to figure that out and to request exceptions if they can't figure it out, if they don't have the labor power, if it's too expensive. You know, that's why there's a five-year plan. So we've kind of mapped that out based on the SUNY system, which has a very clear set of rules about when you can ask for carve-outs, what the exceptions look like, what the exception process looks like.
Caden Palicia online, Zoom.
Hi. Just a point of information. I was wondering if, in the slide where you refer to the research on the pointlessness of recycling or the ineffectiveness of it, could you add to the presentation online some references to the research you cite? Because I'd be interested in seeing that.
Yes, absolutely. It's in the proposal, in the resolution appendix under frequently asked questions, but I can also add it.
Thank you very much.
If there are no more questions or comments, we will move on to our second proposed resolution, establishing an Extension Professor Track, and Eve DeRosa, who is chair of the Extension Professor Track Working Group, will have 10 minutes followed by 20 minutes of discussion.
The irony is that I've never presented in Faculty Senate until today. So this is going to be the longest speech that I've ever given off this floor. Okay, so this is the working group, and these were individuals who were selected by their colleges to the contract colleges that where extension faculty live. And so we had Tony Barrow from CHE and the Bronfenbrenner, We had Diane Burton from ILR. Thank you, Diane, for being here. We had Susie Fubini from the Vet School, and we had Andy Turner from CALS, and he's also the director of CCE. So most important, from our very founding, Cornell is centered on its land grant mission. And its core extension is a core part of our academic mission. It's taking research and scholarship from the campus out into the New York State and also the world. And importantly, it is partnering with industry, communities, agencies, and organizations. And essentially, this resolution is about taking that core academic mission and mapping it onto appropriate titles and career progression. And so some of you who are not in the contract colleges, I happen to be in a contract college, might not have a sense of what extension work is, and so I just wanted to give some sense of what it is. It's faculty-led design and leadership and evaluation of applied programs, so taking that scholarship out and applying it. It's long-term, it's programmatic, and it really requires a reciprocity between your partners out in the community and the extension scientists themselves. And the whole point of extension is building those relationships but also sustaining them over the long term, and that reciprocity between the two. Obviously, there are faculty, so professional independence, judgment, and accountability as any other core academic. I want to make very clear the relationship of this proposal and the use of these titles relative to tenure track faculty. So this is distinct from tenure track. This is a non-tenure track title. It does not carry the expectations of tenure track faculty in terms of both teaching and doctoral supervision and academic communication. And if one was to engage in, for example, doctoral mentorship, that is in sort of in the advancement of extension work. And so the other thing I want to make very clear, the extension associate titles that we currently have will not go away. There's still a need on campus for those titles. This is really for those faculty members who have been limited to senior extension associate for many decades, some of them. They're primarily funding themselves through grants, and so this is an opportunity for career progression for those faculty members. We have already authorized non-tenure track professor titles, clinical professor, professor of the practice, research professor, and obviously most recently, teaching professor. The principle that we've been building on is that professor titles, whether they're tenure track or non-tenure track, are appropriate when a faculty member works, they advance their expertise, they have professional independence and sustained impact. And we'll use the precedent of the recently added teaching professor title, and that's the resolution that we approved 2 years ago. I shouldn't have to do this, but I feel like I it's best to articulate everything. Yes, there's a rationale for why a three-tier progression is meaningful. It supports advancement and retention of high-impact faculty members that are here. Obviously, it can attract high-impact faculty from elsewhere. It allows the senior extension associates that are currently here at Cornell opportunities for greater leadership and growth, professional growth, and it aligns, obviously, with the impact that they have. The standards of advancement, these will all be defined by the implementation protocols that are being brought forward with the colleges if this is approved. And so standards for advancement would look like program leadership or applied innovation, engagement with their stakeholders and partners, external visibility in the work, extension work that they're doing, and obviously peer and external review.
We will use the same path that we used for the teaching professor and other titles like the clinical professor and professor of the practice. We hope to enable the legislation for this title to exist here at Cornell. So if this is approved, then I will go to the board and the board will hopefully give approval, and then the colleges can go work on their implementation plans. The beauty of the system is that the colleges get to keep their autonomy and their distinctness in terms of what extension looks like for them. And that's a critical part of this. So it does include university voting rights, and then college-defined voting rights. They're very distinct across campus. So if this legislation is approved, the colleges would then go and articulate the rationale. They would establish what is the processes that will be for appointment, reappointment, promotion. They will specify, and for this position in particular, when I went to the deans with this proposal, a critical part of this was that these are primarily self-funded, PI-eligible positions. And there has to be an articulation of how someone who is in a senior extension associate position could move potentially to a extension professor title. And most importantly, these are going to be one at a time. There's not a wholesale, everyone who is a senior extension associate will move to being an extension professor, just like we did for the teaching professor. Important to review paths for transition, and then feedback, not just consultation, but genuine feedback, authentic feedback from the extension faculty in the college to help craft the articulation of it. Okay, so colleges are set timelines, everything, the procedures, everything would be set by the colleges if this is approved. Obviously, they would need to come to the Senate for the college-specific approval. And this is critical for those, actually it's beneficial to the colleges, but it's most beneficial in my mind to our faculty members in the senior extension associate titles. Obviously we'll maintain our rigor, and we will, I described already that the colleges will have the flexibility in defining what extension is for them and how that progression happens. These are PI eligible and salaried, primarily salaried through grants and external funding and contracts. This is the resolution as written. So whereas extension is a core academic mission of Cornell as New York's land-grant institution, and whereas the current range of extension titles does not always align with the responsibilities and impact of long-term extension faculty, and whereas Cornell relies on extension faculty for a substantial share of its outreach, engagement, and applied programming, and whereas the responsibilities and impact of long-term extension faculty warrant recognition through an appropriate professorial title distinct from the tenure track, and whereas it's important that professorial extension appointments be governed by clear standards and rigorous review consistent with Cornell's approach to other research, teaching, and extension professorial titles, and whereas it is equally important that there be carefully developed procedures for processing requests to transition individuals from the extension associate track to the extension professor track. Be it resolved that the extension professor track with ranks of assistant extension professor, associate extension professor, and extension professor be added to the university's approved list of academic titles, and be it further resolved that a college or school that wishes to use the extension professor title must do it pursuant to the Faculty Senate approved enabling legislation and a Faculty Senate approved college or school implementation proposal governing the use of that title. I'm passionate about this, and I hope you guys are too.
So we have some time for comments from the audience. If you have a question or comment, just come up to the mic. And we'll try to alternate with the Zoom people, but I don't see any Zoom people now, so we'll start.
Right here.
Bill Catt, RTE. I want to speak in favor of this, and I want to highlight just one specific thing that this will help solve. One item that's come up in our RTE working group is, you know, as we're all being encouraged to apply for more grants from more diverse locations, there are a lot of funding opportunities out there for which the number one requirement is the word professor. You can be perfectly qualified. You can have done all the work. You can have all of your colleagues can have full faith in your abilities. You can have great outreach. And if you do not have the word professor in front of your name, you are not eligible. And so this will help to solve that and help solve the fiscal hole that Cornell has been dealing with due to certain changes beyond our ability to control. This is within our ability to control.
Thank you, Bill. And I want to say that even when you can still submit that grant, some have expressed that it's othering. There is no senior extension associate pull down. And so this is another thing that this will address.
Hi, Iris Packman, ILR RTE. So as a senior extension associate, this is definitely something that interests me. I've heard from colleagues also in extension that they are interested in being able to have this title. I have also heard a lot of concerns that it is a title, but it does not confer any of the protections or benefits of professor. And for those of you privileged enough to be in the tenure track and not familiar with what it is to be an RTE, it is different. It creates two worlds, right? We have those who have the potential to have tenure track and those who sit in a world where that is never a possibility. Being able to call yourself an extension professor is great for some of the external reasons that folks have said, but internally, that does not guarantee you job security in the same way that those of you who are part of the tenure track have. And just to illustrate this point even further, for example, in ILR Now Extension, we usually receive 3 to 5 year appointment letters. Again, we're still at-will employees, so these are not binding contracts. Now they're moving to 1 year appointment letters. Okay, so I'd love to be a professor, but if I only know that I have an appointment letter for 1 year as a professor, you know, for me that's kind of putting a bow on a problem, but not really fixing the underlying issue. And I think there are several or many of my colleagues who feel the same. So I do support the spirit of this, of trying to provide better recognition for and dignity to those who do the very valuable work of extension, but I think we need to go farther and actually give people more protection.
Thank you, Iris. And I can say when we made the shift from senior lecturer to teaching professor, incorporated into that, and this is where the advocacy comes at the college level, and also the fact that the senior extension associates should be really helping with what it looks like in your particular college. But with the teaching professor, what we found is that the contracts were longer. So people were able to get 5 and 10 year contracts instead of 1 or 3.
Hi, Dan Halbert, LISA for MAP. I just have a clarifying question. So how is this different than how is this doing something that couldn't be accomplished by giving more people the title of professor of practice or clinical professor? Like, how is this different than what we already have?
And anyone who's in extension, feel free to come up here. I'm going to do my best. As I understand it, it's a completely different form of scholarship. And so a clinical professor is typically someone, and also the professor of the practice, somebody who's been in industry for a long time who comes to educate at Cornell. This is the opposite. This is taking scholarship at Cornell and translating it into the community to have it. To have impact.
Thank you, Elliot Shapiro, RT at large from Arts and Sciences. This is actually a response to the question, and it may be less relevant because I'm speaking from Arts and Sciences. I don't know how much extension work there is within Arts and Sciences. I know it's more present in some other colleges. Yeah, that's what I thought. That was the amount I thought. But for example, the way professors of the practice was constructed in Arts and Sciences, it very explicitly excluded many of the people who were already here in other RTE roles. And so even if there's potential overlap, the nice thing about this is that it really spells out who falls in this category, who might not be covered by some of the titles that already exist.
Okay. Debbie Cherney, Animal Sciences. I have had the pleasure to work with a large number of extension associates. I have also, I started my career as a senior extension associate, and I know that having the title helps. It is more, I know it's the first step, but it really helps out there because I've had people say, oh, you don't have to worry about writing grants. Isn't that great? But I said, oh, or having students to do things with. And I said, oh, it's wonderful not to be able to get money for the work I do. And things like that. So I think the title is important. And I know many other land-grant universities already have that title because they've recognized the people, many of them who have PhDs in our department and others, but we've just lost a very fine young man who was a senior extension personnel to another university, and it was for more opportunity. So, thank you.
Are there any more comments or questions about this? If not, we're going to move on to the third and final proposed resolution, which involves updates to the Faculty Advisory Committee on Athletics and Physical Education bylaws. Ashley Newman, Population Development and Diagnostic Sciences, will have 5 minutes, after which there'll be 10 minutes for discussion. Is she online? Okay, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Sorry I couldn't be there in person. My name is Ashley Newman, and as you said, I am the chair of FACAPE. Next slide, please. Next slide. Perfect. So to provide some background of what is FACAPE, we are one of the faculty senate committees, and as the name implies, concerned with how programs of the Department of Athletics and Physical Education can best complement and support the overall objectives of the university. Laid out here is our current committee composition, and we have 13 voting members, 9 of which are faculty, put forth by the Nominations and Elections Committee, as with other Senate committees. And we have 4 student members, and 2 are the Red Key Honor Society co-presidents, and 2 are students, one of which must be an undergraduate, and they should be selected annually by the staffing committee of the student assembly. We have several ex officio members who are non-voting, who are listed here, as well as additional non-voting staff who attend our meetings and provide really valuable advisory input. For example, the director of physical education and recreational services, who's one person currently, and the senior deputy AD for student athlete experience, who has a lot of knowledge, as well as knowledge around compliance. Next slide, please. So this resolution is intended to update our bylaws to really make them more reflect the current work of our committee and the academic support structures now in place at Cornell. And what really started it was to amend the committee composition, specifically surrounding student representation. And I'll start there. Next slide. So to give you some background, what is Red Key? I found out through some digging that it was started as the Red Key, and it was established in 1923 for the purpose of greeting and entertaining visiting teams to Cornell's campus, as well as all visitors to Cornell. Now known as the Red Key Athlete Honor Society, it's a leadership organization comprised of junior and senior student athletes who are committed to academic excellence, fellowship among Cornell athletes, and community outreach. Then in 1987, FACAPE was established by the Faculty Council of Representatives, the former name of the Faculty Senate, and that combined the Committee on Physical Education and Council on Physical Education. Then in 1989, the NCAA formed the Student Athlete Advisory Committee, or SAC, and then that expanded into 3 national SACs in 1997, representing Division I, II, and III athletics. SAC allows student athletes to provide insight on their experience and offer input on the rules, regulations, and policies that affect their lives on NCAA member institution campuses. The NCAA legislation mandates that all member institutions and conferences have their own SAC, and so Cornell's SAC was established in 1995. Then in 2007, FACAPE approved the addition of Cornell's Faculty Athletic Representative, or FAR, as an ex officio member of FACAPE. And the FAR, who is John Sipple here at Cornell, is recognized as the representative of the institution and its faculty in the relationship with the NCAA and our local campus. Next slide, please. So this is our proposed committee composition with the changes highlighted in red. So given that SAC is the nationally recognized student organization for shared governance and consists of student representation from all of Cornell's varsity athletic teams, we feel that it makes sense to have them, their co-presidents, as full voting members of FACAPE. And to maintain our voting numbers, we propose reclassifying the two students. Typically has been one representative from the SA and one from the GPSA to non-voting ex officio members. We feel that both SAC and Red Key would bring different perspectives and be active contributors to our committee. Next slide. Moving on to the proposed changes to the charges, some are minor in terms of wording. One, you know, saying the schedules for each team, I feel like that wrongly implies that our committee is involved in making the schedules for varsity athletic teams, and that's certainly not within our purview, but certainly the leaves and absences. Next slide. So here to more call out what the committee chair, who currently is myself, the role, and I review the competition schedules that are put forth by the coaching staff in conjunction with student athlete support services, and to review them and make sure they're in accordance with the FACAPE missed class time policy, which was formalized in 2018. Next slide, please. And really, this was the focus, too, of why we wanted to revise the charges. Because when I became chair, I wanted to say, okay, am I doing everything I'm supposed to be doing, that our committee's supposed to be doing? And we are certainly not giving a series of seminars for all freshman athletes on library skills, study and reading skills. Nor are we meeting with captains of all of the teams to discuss athletics and academics and the role of captains as academic role models. And if anything, our committee felt that captains of a team are chosen typically for their athletic ability, not necessarily as an academic role model. So the language there below is what we have proposed as a revision. Again, to acknowledge that there are resources now at Cornell for all students, including the Learning Strategy Center, with professionals who are much more well-suited to talk about study skills, reading skills, et cetera, the Cornell Library, and student-athletes also have now access to the resources with the Student-Athlete Support Services Group within the athletic department. So best served by those people and not a rotating Senate committee. Next slide. Lastly, this is the resolution as it is written for you all to see. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Come up if you have any questions from here. And if you're online, raise your hand.
All right.
Thank you, Elliot Shapiro, RTE at large from Arts and Sciences. And it's weird, I assume, like, Ashley's behind my head, but am I looking at you through the camera? Right.
So yeah, I'm seeing you.
Yeah, okay, great. Thank you. So I appreciate very much everything you've done to update the committee charges and so forth, but there's one thing that I have a question about or an objection to based on the way I understand it, which is that the committee is athletics and physical education, and as I understand it, the essentially two student representatives who are not necessarily athletes are being replaced by two students who are athletes representative on the committee. And of course, athletes represent a fraction of the population. Physical education serves everybody and is also more connected to the rest of the Cornell community. Given the ways that being an athlete at Cornell and other universities can serve to sort of isolate you in some ways from the rest of the student experience, I see the logic of including those representatives on the committee of the student-athlete groups, but I have concerns about taking the non-athlete
without
student
the
representatives
AI-powered
the group
that are
as representatives. Sorry. What? has nothing to do with you. And so that for me represents a potentially serious objection to the proposal as written, even though the rest of it looks really great to me. And perhaps there's a rationale that I'm missing apart from just the numbers of voting members on the committee. But I have real concerns about making this a committee just supporting student athletes without the voices of non-athletes on the committee.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I can say that historically, and if you look at the makeup of all the faculty senate committees, like Zora Duram, the current FA president, is on every single faculty senate committee, and I'm sure she can't go to every meeting. So typically these two student members, the SA and GPSA members, in my time on the committee have never attended our meetings, have never voted, and so they are not active participants. So I reached out and certainly wrote this resolution and direct consultation with Eve, wanting to make sure, is there a limit on the ratio of faculty to students on faculty senate committees, not wanting to exceed that. And so her concern with adding two more was we wanted to make sure we actually had a quorum in meetings, and with those two students who often don't attend and don't, you know, aren't necessarily engaged with the work, that adding two students who are more invested and engaged in the work was the rationale. Also, I'll add that another impetus for this was that the athletic director, the NCAA, mandates that SAC is involved in administration meetings, and having them be involved with FACAPE would satisfy that they are engaged in conversations surrounding academics and athletics at their member institution.
Hi, Chris Schaefer, Biomedical Engineering. Could I ask what was the SA and GPSA's views of these proposed changes and how they would be placing representatives on the committee?
Great question. I shared this resolution. We started it in the fall working on it and shared it through Google Doc and asked for collective opinions, have talked about it over email, have talked about it in our meetings, and have received no feedback from them with any of those engagement efforts. So I have not heard any objection from them.
And I can say that the Red Key and the SAC students are exceptional academic students as well.
Hi, John Sippel from Global Development and the Faculty Athletic Representative. As far as the integration of the student-athletes with the rest of the student body, there's 1,200 student-athletes. It's not a small group of 300, so there's 1,200, so about 10% of our student body are student-athletes. And they're in virtually every major across campus, so I think there's a lot of interaction. I just wanted to just push back a touch on that notion that they're separate somehow from the rest of society here, when they're much more integrated here than most universities, I would say that. It's still 10%, but anyway, I support the resolution with Ashley.
Are there other questions or comments from the audience here? I see none on Zoom.
And just to follow up too, we have many, many non-voting members, as you saw from that committee composition. They are all active members, so they are all welcome at all meetings. They give reports. We hear a physical education report, the director of athletics reports. They don't vote. So these two students are not being removed from the committee. They're just in a non-voting role. But I would very much welcome and encourage their attendance and participation in the committee and, you know, get their, you know, discussion on issues. And when I started my term as chair, I specifically just emailed the students on the committee to try and encourage them to attend and provide input.
Thank you. We're going to move on to our next item of business, which are announcements and updates. Eve DeRosa, Dean of Faculty, and Adam T. Smith, Associate Dean of Faculty, will have 10 minutes, followed by 10 minutes for Q&A.
Next slide, please. So congratulations to all of our faculty elected. We have our dean elect over here and Chris Schaefer, and our and our faculty trustee elect
over here.
I'm out of the meeting.
And throughout the room, we have USC and at our at-large senator. So thank you, everyone who is willing to put their name on the ballot. We're very, very appreciative. I thought we had a fantastic ballot, and we have fantastic results. So I appreciate that. I just want to let you guys know that there's one less pop-up lunch. It's going to be in the College of Human Ecology. On those days, we don't have lunch at the Statler. I hope you'll come. It's a beautiful location looking over BB Lake, and so that's our last one of the year. And I wanted to know, let you know that officially the university has said that they are doing an investigation of the incident involving President Kotlikoff. So that's what I can give as an update as of now. I wanted to take you back to 2022, around 4 years ago. I presented this data slide. And this is what I want to share. Okay, so when I first started as dean of faculty, I wanted to understand who was actually being heard. So Jonathan and I implemented 2 minutes for each person to speak, because I had watched hours and hours, or actually at that time I was listening, hours and hours and hours of faculty senate meetings. And I was only hearing a few voices. So I wanted to be able to track who was speaking. And this is a snapshot of April 2022. 130 senators, nearly 100 of them had never uttered a word. A very small number of people dominated the floor. In fact, just 8 senators, many of whom were resolution sponsors, they accounted for over 50% of the conversation. And that's conservative, because it was not a perfect system. And this is not about bad intentions. It's about culture. Who felt comfortable speaking? Who felt invited? And whose voices became normalized over time? I believe then, and I believe now, that a representative body only works if representation shows up, not just in the seats, and thank you very much for showing up in the seats, I appreciate that, but also in voices. And I am appreciative also that over these past 5 years, we have heard from more of you. I'm so, so appreciative of that. I think we have done a really good job of that. So I worked intentionally to change the culture with Associate Deans Nima Kudva and Chelsea Specht and Adam T. Smith. We made space. We encouraged first-time speakers, Jonathan, well, sorry, Jonathan. We signaled that participation was expected and not exceptional. The Senate today does not look or sound like this slide anymore. More people speak, more perspectives enter the conversation. The distribution is still not perfect, I will own that, but it's meaningfully better. And so what I hope lasts longer than any single resolution or rule change is this norm, that the Senate belongs to all senators, and that every voice matters for the work we do together. And thank you for being a part of that change. And I can't help myself, Jonathan. I am so sorry, but we had to do it. So this is a resolution to honor Jonathan Oxern for his service as Speaker of the Faculty Senate. Whereas Professor Jonathan Oxern has served with distinction as Speaker of the Faculty Senate for 5 years, and whereas the effective functioning of the Faculty Senate depends on leadership that is attentive to process, respectful of faculty voices, and able to guide complex discussions with clarity and fairness, and whereas Jonathan has led Senate meetings that were consistently full and demanding, keeping discussion focused, how millennial, keeping discussion focused and moving so that substantial work was completed efficiently and thoughtfully. And whereas Jonathan, 5 years as Speaker, reflect a rare combination of patience, judgment, and stamina, sustained across many standard semesters of earnest deliberation and no small quantity of faculty suits. And
whereas he has brought to this role the same care, discipline, and commitment that have characterized his long service to Cornell University as a scholar, educator, and colleague. Be it resolved that the Faculty Senate, on behalf of the faculty, extend its deep, appreciative, and sincere thanks to Jonathan for his exemplary service as Speaker of the Faculty Senate and for 5 years of steady leadership that enabled the Senate to carry out its work effectively and with purpose. And be it further resolved that in recognition of this service and in honor of Jonathan's birthday, the Faculty Senate marked this occasion by singing Happy Birthday. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Happy
birthday to you. Okay. Are you going to say anything, Jonathan? I highly recommend this for emeritus or retired faculty because it enables one to keep a kind of connection to the university, which I found sort of nice. So I'll miss you all.
Hi, everyone. Adam Smith from Anthropology and Associate Dean of the Faculty. I first of all want to echo Eve's remarks about the elections and appointments process. In my first year as Associate Dean of the Faculty, it was extremely gratifying to see how invested faculty were all across the university in participating in faculty governance in all different shapes and sizes. So I really want to extend my appreciation and thanks to all of you. But today I am here, first of all, in my capacity as co-chair of the Future of the American University Committee. And I wanted to provide you with a brief update. If you scan the QR codes in the upper right, you will have access to the preliminary frameworks that we released about 2 weeks ago. These were frameworks that were investigations of the future of the four core missions that make up the university, so undergraduate education, research and scholarship, graduate and professional education, and public impact and engagement. And these documents were the results of over 200 meetings. More than 2,200 individuals were engaged in the process, including all of the major assemblies. And what these frameworks represent is our effort to provide a first pass of a set of ideas that emerged out of our conversations with all of you. And what we're doing now is we are in the midst of a whirlwind campus tour where we are having 16 town halls. Who's counting? Let's see. Next slide, I think Jill is on. Yeah. So some of those have already come and gone, but we are very eager to connect with you. If you haven't had a chance to engage with us yet, you're clearly avoiding us because there's no way you could have missed us. We are very eager for your feedback, and if you have a moment, please send it in either through our email or there's a survey online that you can take. What's going to happen next is the FAU is going to take in all of this feedback that we're getting from the town halls and the further engagement with our preliminary frameworks. And we're going to spend the summer reviewing it all and attending to a number of cross-cutting issues that surfaced through all of this stakeholder engagement, but that did not fit squarely in the four core missions. Things like faculty governance and campus governance, academic structures, pluralism on campus. These are issues that emerged from our conversations, but they didn't fit squarely into one of the core missions. So we really want to take the time to do some deep thought and thinking around those. And the idea is that we will be releasing a report in the beginning of the fall semester. Don't hold me to that, but I really would like it to be the early fall semester. And we're passing off to a next committee, the Shaping Our Future Committee, which is going to be composed of people from all across the university, staff, faculty, students, trustees, et cetera, everybody. And it's going to be their job to take the insights of the FAU and translate into strategic initiatives that can be realizable on campus. So you can reach us, next slide. Through any of these, use the QR code again, or the survey or email. And now, while I have the floor and the recognition of this guest buddy, I'm going to ask Jill to cue up my second topic for my announcements. Is it okay, Jonathan, if I make a resolution from the floor? I've only been here 1 year, so this is my first announcement. So, my first resolution. So.
Hang on.
Okay.
It's on the secret server.
Ah, that's good. Okay. As you might have guessed, I would like to forward a resolution that would honor Eve DeRosa for her service as Dean of Faculty. This resolution will read in a matter of moments.
Happy birthday.
You could see.
There we go.
Got it. All right. Whereas Professor Eve DeRosa has served as the Cornell University Dean of Faculty for 5 years, and whereas the last 5 years have presented higher education with unprecedented challenges to its mission and values, and whereas the Dean of Faculty has served as an effective advocate for the faculty to the president, trustees, and administration, and whereas the Dean of Faculty has promoted the processes surrounding shared governance by assuring that a wide variety of voices are heard in constructive, respectful, and deliberative processes, as she just showed us the evidence, and whereas the Dean of the Faculty has empowered the work of Faculty Senate committees, and whereas the Dean of Faculty has enhanced collective understanding of the operation of the Faculty Senate through orientations and briefings, and whereas the Dean of Faculty has provided compassionate support to faculty navigating an array of challenges, and whereas the Dean of Faculty has promoted inclusion of Cornell academics and professors emeriti in matters across the Cornell campuses, and whereas the Dean of Faculty has brought the voice of the faculty into extensive consultations on consequential matters across the campus, and whereas the Dean of Faculty has been a constant part of every faculty member's Monday email, and whereas the Dean of Faculty made the activities of the office visible, transparent, and organized through an extended reorganization of its web presence, and whereas Eve DeRosa's service as Dean of the Faculty will conclude on June 30th, 2026. Therefore, be it resolved that the Faculty Senate expresses its abiding and everlasting appreciation to Eve DeRosa for her distinguished service to Cornell University and wishes her a well-earned re-immersion in the fulfilling work of research and teaching. I want to remind everyone that there is a recognition book if you'd like to throw in some comments or more memories for you.
I have to first say thank you to the faculty for electing me in this position. It's been incredibly fulfilling. This work does not happen without the Office of the Dean of Faculty, Jill Short, C.A. Schugertz, and Melissa Rickle. So the three of them are the office. They are your advocates as well. And I can say that they have a lot of passion and also expertise and care. And I will also say the dean is transient. So they are the office. And so I would like to congratulate them and thank them.
And before we move on to our final good of the order, I would just, through unanimous consent, and I am not hearing any objections, we will consider this resolution accepted. I don't know, mine was a real resolution. I got the selfie, that's all that counts. Okay, we have a little bit more time than expected, although there is a reception out there, which also is an issue to consider as we speak, for the good of the order. We have three faculty members. We're going to start with Rajesh Laskaran. And please say your name correctly when you get up here and identify yourself. And maybe you can take a little more than a minute and a half.
Rajesh Bhaskaran, Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering, RTE faculty member and senator. This semester I've been teaching an engineering simulations class with about 100 students. About a month into the semester, I noticed that students' attention was already getting scattered and they had trouble retaining concepts from earlier in the semester. I do have a slide.
Oh.
And while that's coming up, so around this time, as I was watching the students,
Oh, sorry. Did I not include?
Okay. No issues. around this time, you know, as I was watching students' attention being scattered, and you know them having trouble retaining concepts from early in the semester, I was using Poll Everywhere in the class, and I asked them. Usually, I ask them technical questions, and I asked them the question using the word cloud feature in Poll Everywhere. In one word, how are you feeling today? And in the resulting word cloud, the winner was tired, followed by stressed. And the last class, which was 2 days back, I asked the same question, and stressed won out over tired. So the well-being and scholarly environments, or WISE program from Cornell Health, has many thoughtful suggestions on small changes that instructors can implement in the classroom to support student well-being. One of the suggestions is to provide a mindfulness minute at the beginning of class. Inspired by this, I implemented what I call the 2-minute device-free mental health break at the start of my class. And, you know, we use simulation software, so we need the device to do the modeling. I asked students to, and, you know, in the 2 minutes, I asked students to first notice that there are almost always a lot of thoughts in the mind, some of them stressful. This promotes a subtle but powerful reframing, which is that stressful thoughts are coming into the mind rather than I'm stressed. This gives them a taste of metacognition. Then we, you know, get out of, as I call it, get out of the mind and into the body, and without wanting anything to happen. And essentially what we are doing is we are foregrounding raw sensations in the body without, you know, with curiosity. Research shows that this activates a different part of the brain than the mental chatter, which is self-focused, and it has this, this settling impact. And then we end by, you know, just setting the intention to be available for the next next 45 minutes or so without judgment so that we can learn together. And this is a flipped classroom, so we're working, you know, students are working a lot with each other. When I led the class through this brief routine before the prelim review, there was thin drop silence. Students were tired, but the silence was rejuvenating. Before the prelim, the following class, I wasn't planning to lead it, but one of the students said, hey, you should lead the 2-minute, you know, mental health break. And, you know, I did it. And then later in the semester, a few weeks later, when I surveyed students asking them if they wanted to continue doing this, 94% responded in the affirmative. So I continued doing it for the rest of the semester. So the first program I wanted to call out was WISE or Wellbeing in Scholarly Environments. I see it over here. And then the second is Let's Meditate. So I have been leading a longer version of this 2-minute, device-free mental health break. This is a half-hour session as part of Cornell Health's Let's Meditate program. And my final session is on Wednesday, May 13th. I'm used to, you know, seeing the screen at the back. So my final session is on Wednesday, May 13th, 10 to 10:30 in 106 Upson Hall. And so if this is of interest, you're welcome to check this out, as, you know, some students in my class did. It'd be lovely to see you there. A few years back, my department had a workshop for faculty conducted by then what is called IDP and now the Center for Dialogue and Pluralism.
which is the third program listed there. And this is part of a DEI initiative, which is probably not a thing anymore. And the workshop facilitators left us with a community agreement containing statements, be here now and embrace discomfort. These are among the skills we are practicing in my Let's Meditate sessions. In the age of disruption from AI and climate change, the mental health issues are likely not going away. We cannot, as the quip goes, we cannot address these problems using the same kind of thinking that created them in the first place. So we need to think outside the box. But the good news is that modern science, drawing on ancient spiritual practices, points to a set of mind training practices that promote attention and mental health at a community level. So I think there's an exciting opportunity for Cornell to draw on the latest research, as well as the three programs I've highlighted, to integrate this dimension of mind training, which is complementary to the conventional mind training that we provide, into the formal educational system.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next speaker, for the good of the order, is Alexandra Lahav, law school and oh, also Mao Ye, SC Johnson College of Business. That three is okay.
Thanks so much for taking the time to hear us. My name is Alexandra Lahav. I'm in the law school, not a senator. This is Mao, who, among other things, is serving as a co-chair of the ICSD Cornell Advisory Committee, and Xiaodong, who's a professor in the math department, and we also have the chair of the math department here as well, new trustee. If you could move to the next slide. So we're here to talk to you about dual enrollment, a program that used to exist before COVID and was canceled for reasons that are shrouded in mystery. We want to just highlight two reasons why this program should be reinstituted as soon as possible. And we are in dialogue with President Kotlikoff and the provost about it, but we would really like to open up the dialogue with Chris and maybe other faculty. And so this is sort of an opening salvo, hoping that we'll have further conversations about it. I don't want those conversations to go on too long because both our time is short here, but also we'd like to get some students some opportunities. There are two reasons why you should support this. The first is altruistic, which is it's really good for the Ithaca community. The high school has difficulty providing really high quality educational opportunities for the students who are excelling and have completed what's available at the high school. This is a way to get them on our campus, and it speaks to or relates to things that we're really excellent at, like teaching high-performing, brilliant students. So that's, and there's nice ways that we can use this as one of the, you know, mosaic or portfolio of ways that we connect with the local community. The second thing is constraints in faculty hiring and retention. Our own individual experience has been that some faculty choose to commute from very far away, or they choose not to come here and to come somewhere else. Other comparable universities offer this type of dual enrollment program. Xiaodong has seen it with students who are matriculating, who've taken classes at Princeton because their parents teach there or they live in that community. Dartmouth also has that. The last thing I would say is that, so I think people who are brilliant, who have comparable opportunities, might choose somewhere not Cornell because we don't offer this, and so we should offer it. The last thing I would say is this is very strongly supported by the students at IHS. So we have a petition, and you are absolutely welcome to look at it, with 400 signatures from IHS students. Students aren't allowed to come before the Senate, I guess, in very, very rare circumstances. And so we don't have the high school students here, but I want you to know this is something that they really want. Not all of them are going to take advantage of it, but enough of them are going to take advantage that I think this is a really good idea. My last point, and then I'll open up to my co-conspirators here, is that we have had a discussion with the chair of math and worked out how it would be possible to implement this, at least for two courses, that would be appropriate for high school students to be enrolled in. There may be other departments where this could be done, and we would like to start that conversation. So all of you here, you could talk to your chairs or come talk to us. If you're worried about feasibility, you know, in a minute and a half, we just don't have the time to go into it, but I'm happy to talk to you about what we've heard over the past basically year that we've been working through this, and why we think that whatever barriers exist really are possible to overcome. So thank you very much. What we want is just your support and the opening up of a conversation about this.
Do you guys have something you want to add?
I think Lansing High School also signed the petition, so.
Yeah, so I still have some time, right? So I heard I only have 1.5 minutes, so we let Alexander to speak. But since we have time, let me just point out one thing. It's unprepared. So I graduated from Cornell, and I was student trustee before, and I love Cornell. So Cornell cannot hire its own graduates. That's the reason I was on exile for 12 years before I came back. Let me tell you one thing. The first thing I noticed, actually, when I came back is the decline and the challenge faced by the school district. And I fear it more and more. It helps us to attract tenure faculty members. We try to make offer to someone, and they look at the news about the school district. Unfortunately, almost no news is good. And I have colleagues who been hired away because of the challenge of the school district. That's another example. And I have colleagues who are on our faculty choose to live in other places. And they attend all the meetings. They have to like live in other places. It's not because other places have better schools, public schools. It's because our school district used to be very good. So we don't have private school here. So let me be honest, before the Fed Fund challenge, I talked with the university. This is probably one of the most fundamental challenges for faculty retention and recruiting, and also it's like for faculty engagement. So that's the reason, finally, I'm in that committee of ICSD and Cornell community. We think about different ways. Some of them, for example, there are people ask for $10 million from Cornell University. That's one possibility. But reopen dual enrollment is definitely the quickest, most cost-efficient way for us to engage in local community and also to help us to retain and recruit the best and brightest faculty member to my alma mater, which I love a lot. I hope you also love Cornell a lot. Thank you.
I think we have a final good of the order, probably on Zoom. Richard Bensel, are you there?
I am. I'm not going to keep everybody from the reception.
You're good.
Oh, sorry, Pete. I'm not going to keep everybody from the reception. I would just note that we have 15 minutes left, and there was more than enough time to have presented the resolution that would have recorded the sentiments of the faculty on the revision of the Code of Student Conduct. That's it.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, everybody. If you're on Zoom and you can walk up to Sattler, please come. Eve, you have something final to say?
I forgot to thank Jeff, IT, especially today where we're in this new environment, but Jeff and Liam also have been really wonderful in how they support us at Rockefeller, so please come have a beer on us.
And we are adjourned.
Yeah, but...